icy draft whistled through the flimsy, moisture-drenched rear window of the 1976 beige Citroen Diane as it whizzed along a shadowy, whitethorn and ash-bordered country road. It was just before dawn, on an exceptionally chilly January morning, and I was sitting in the faded, uncomfortable rear seat of the car, arms folded against the cold, while the driver and front seat passenger engaged in an animated conversation about the joys of nature and the outdoor life. As I pulled my dark woolen hat down more tightly on my head, I thought to myself that one did not have to leave the confines of this particular vehicle to be exposed to harsh elements of the great outdoors. I was a shy and introverted 16-year-old teenager who was happy to remain in the distant realms of the rear back seat, while the two extroverts in the front vocalized freely. The driver, Pat, was a young school biology teacher with a shock of already graying black hair, bushy black eyebrows, and a permanent 5 o'clock shadow. He was a friendly type, but a bit threatening to my emotional sensitivities, being slightly eccentric and prone to unexpected, spontaneous shows of emotion. Sean was a recent past pupil of Pat's, who had offered to act as his guide for the morning and accompany him to see a fen in a bog out in the wilds of North County Dublin and show him some of its wild inhabitants. Sean was 20, and in my eyes, a man of the world, who had the demeanour of one who knew about things in life that were beyond my experience. I was only invited on this little outing at Sean's request, and was always happy to follow in the wake of his forays in life, as my introversion and shyness were a real disability to me in getting the experiences I hungered for. Sean was a bit of a renegade Dubliner, who found solace in wild places and liked to be around the odd and the unusual, and I guess that's where Pat and myself came in. "Left after the next telegraph pole," Sean gestured, and Pat swerved the Diane erratically into a narrow, potholed, grass-centered bog road. "Looks like cars don't come down here much," Pat said, as he gripped the wheel with intent and guided the French designer bean can down the route used mainly by rabbits and other local wildlife. The car's headlights lit the bumpy, undulating way for 10 minutes until Sean suddenly announced, "See that wooden gate? We can park there." "It's a cold one," Pat said, as in the half-light of early dawn, all three of us unfolded ourselves from the inside of the car. Early morning mists were lifting and vanishing slowly, like ghostly whispers, as we plodded along overland towards the fen. The drowned soil tried to suck every Wellington-booted step downwards, as if to try and nourish itself with our presence. The frosty air and quietness of the early morning gave a subdued, echoing quality to our intermittent conversations, as Sean stopped us now and then along the way to point out some wild plant or animal. The ground became more bog-like as we approached the lake's reed mace and bulrush fringes, with dark green stands of needle-tipped rushes grouped like sentinels around its approaches. "Stay really quiet now," Sean said, in a hushed tone, as we blended ourselves in among the brown, capsule-topped bulrush stems. Really quiet was not part of Pat's normal behaviour, and you could sense he was struggling to follow Sean's instructions. It was a cold, windless morning, probably a degree or two above freezing, and the lake surface was clear and smooth, mirroring the light grey cumulus clouds drifting by overhead. Occasional rays of early morning sunlight stippled the lake surface and danced among the reed mace stems where the three of us crouched in hiding. To a casual observer, the only evidence of our presence at the lakeside was the occasional cloud of condensed, exhaled breath as Sean interjected quietly with jewels of knowledge about the natural history of the fen. "It was formed after the last ice age ended thousands of years ago," he said, trying to impress, while drawing Pat's attention to a small flock of diving duck feeding out on the lake. Individual ducks dived, only to pop back up again, innocently swimming along as if they had never disappeared below the surface. A coot called from the far reaches of the fen as images of the ice-encased landscape that once existed here excited my imagination. In my mind's eye, I saw a great glacier, an earth-shaper, hundreds of feet thick, and so dense from its overlying mass, it gave off a hue of aquamarine from its terrifying depths. I almost shivered at the thought of the freezing, flesh-numbing winds that tore across its surface, making it impossible for life to exist there, and shuddered as I imagined great booming sounds echoing across the forbidding landscape, as ice shifted and fissured within the glacier as it moved imperceptibly like a gargantuan, creaking wooden ship. I shifted into a more comfortable position, and moisture-laden bulrush stems brushed against my face, stirring me out of my reverie. The lake formed in a hollow, scooped out of the landscape by an overlying glacier, Sean informed us, as we noticed a wave of nervous calling spread through the feeding flock of duck. Sean motioned us to stay very still, for he knew from experience that this type of behavior was often an indication of the presence of some predatory animal or bird of prey. Pat whispered, "What is it, Sean?" And as if on cue, there was a disturbance out on the surface of the water, not more than 20 feet from where we lay, camouflaged in the reeds. To our surprise and delight, a flat, squat, whiskered face of an otter emerged from the water, and the fact that it held a pale, yellow, 3-foot, squirming eel in its jaws increased our excitement. The water dog started to swim directly towards the lake edge where we were in hiding and climbed out of the water with its prize right in front of us. Amazingly, the otter, although on high alert, did not sense our presence, and with audible salivating, gripping and grasping sounds, it tried to subdue its writhing, slippery prey with its jaws and feet. Patience in watching nature can sometimes be rewarded with some jewel of intimacy with her wild creatures, and this scene was our reward during those precious moments at the fen. But what happened next could never have been planned or expected, and was like something one only read about in some jungle survival tale. Sean and I were so absorbed by the scene unfolding in front of us that we had not noticed the increasing excitement of the eccentric Pat, and the fact that he was leaning slowly forward in a way that made it look like he was ready to pounce. And that is exactly what he did. The otter, Sean, and myself were taken totally by surprise as Pat launched himself forward and grabbed at the eel, which was curling and entwining its sinuous body around the clawed, webbed feet of the otter. "Jesus!" Sean exclaimed to himself as the otter fled and Pat turned triumphantly with the contorting eel clenched in his right hand and rushed to his haversack and stuffed its squirming body into the dark interior. The hissing of an annoyed swan nearby just about summed up how the creatures around the lake felt about this disturbance to their daily routines, and the eel's life story was far from over. Back on the road, our destination, Pat's house. Sean and I laughed nervously as Pat drove erratically, chatting and gesticulating excitedly about the morning's events. I sat apprehensively in the back seat, very aware of Pat's lack of attention to his driving, and also to the slithering sounds coming from behind me in the small boot of the Diane. It sounded as if the eel was still alive and kicking, and trying to make an escape. Jokingly, Sean asked, "And what's your plans for the eel, Pat?" "Dinner," Pat replied, his blue, mischievous eyes twinkling as he looked back in my direction, hungry for a reaction. "Great," I smiled uncomfortably, as I tried to give the impression that I was agreeable to Pat's line of thinking. Pat's kitchen was small and felt crowded with the three of us in it. The still very alive eel had been scooped up and dropped unceremoniously into a large red bucket where it writhed uncontrollably. I could see its jet-black wild eyes looking at me, and it made me uneasy, and even more so when Pat chopped off its head on a well-used wooden chopping board. Now, I'll show you both how the French cook eel, he said with gusto. I looked at the slime-covered head and staring eyes of the decapitated eel and wondered at the day's events. This eel had escaped death twice that day before it met its final demise in Pat's suburban kitchen. It had escaped certain death from the jaws of an otter in a watery fen which had formed in the aftermath of an ice age, and survived a potential road traffic incident as it travelled in the boot of a French-designed motor vehicle. Now it was going to be a meal for three human beings. An old blackened steel pan was placed on a hot stove, and finger-sized portions of fresh eel were dropped into hot oil and allowed to cook and sizzle.
Look, they're still moving, Sean said amusedly.
To my astonishment, the eel portions were still wriggling as they were being cooked, and I was amazed to think that even the individual portions of eel were still trying to cling onto life. What a tough animal, I thought to myself. Three plates were set, knives and forks provided, and I tasted fresh, otter-caught eel for the first and probably last time in my life. Looking back, I can still see the lifeless, smoky black eyes of that eel looking at me, and how it had affected me. I wondered, had it had any real sense of truly existing, or was its experience of its life confined to explosions of energetic, unconscious reactions to its environment and the drive for survival? In contrast, I had lived and functioned up until then, dominated by continual waves of reactive emotions to both people and my environs. The eel seemed to only just exist, and it was my thoughts that gave it meaning and life. So back then, as the three men of different personalities and differing emotions shared in nature's bounty, it may not have seemed clear at the time that this was a moment of consequence, and that it was for me a rite of passage marked by the sharing of a meal of otter-caught eel and a shaping of a character as life passed ever onward like the imperceptible and relentless earth-shaping advance of a great ice age glacier.
That was Reminiscence, An Ice Age, An Otter and an Eel by Paul McMahona, read by Angus Ogh McAnally, produced by Aoife Ní Cormac.